She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And I believe this show and our guest today will give all of us a great deal to think about and hopefully inspire us to act in ways that really matter. But before we jump into the show, I'd like to thank the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. Their motto about community giving back and sustainable practices is doing our share, showing we care. And they do that by constantly walking the walk in many areas, including their support of Mrs. Green's World mission and vision. And needless to say, I thank them for that. And Chapman, I thank you for all the good things you do for our planet and for our community. And so now, on to navigating science in a post-fact world. It's kind of an out-of-body experience that we're even having this conversation, but I would be hard-pressed to think of two individuals who are better able to address this issue than the two people joining me in studio for this next hour. Please join me in welcoming and celebrating the presence of James Beiser, Deputy Director for Climate Adaptation and International Development, Institute of the Environment, Professor of Climate Adaptation, School of Natural Resources and the Environment, and Kathy Jacobs, Director for Climate Adaptation, Science and Solutions. They're both professors at the University of Arizona. Jim and Kathy, I think you both know how excited I am to get you here. It's really great to have these brains for an hour. So thanks for coming. Let's talk about, for this next hour, what I believe to be the biggest threat in the history of our planet, climate change, and we'll cover many aspects of that. But let's start with something really basic. From your observations, when did facts, especially as they relate to hardcore scientific research, stop mattering? It's very recent. So who wants to field that one first?
Well, thanks for the question, and thanks also for inviting us to join you today. I think there's always been a lot of skepticism about science, and that's actually a good thing, because if you're not skeptical, you're probably not a good scientist. I think the issue is the way this is now a political football, as opposed to really people being focused on whether or not someone's telling the truth. It now appears that telling the truth is not necessary.
It doesn't matter.
And historically, that really mattered. I mean, it brought politicians down when they lied. And now it appears that we're in a very different world. And I think it's very likely related to the Trump situation. But it clearly was an undercurrent that existed well before this.
So it kind of brought things to the surface in many areas. I think that's what this current administration is doing. Things that I thought were dead and what lies beneath, I thought they were buried, and they're absolutely not. Jim, do you want to add to that?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think that Kathy is exactly right. It has always been. And but to your point, it's the recent issues have, I believe, something to do with social media. When you use social media for what its intended purpose is, it's a wonderful thing. So the ubiquitous sort of presence of the internet and how you can use it, particularly how you can use it anonymously, has allowed for this confusion between what is true and what is fact and what isn't. And if you create falsehoods but make them look like fact, all you have to do is put some sort of banner on and let people know or think that this is true. That kind of confusion has actually become politically advantageous for some.
You know, I think about recently, things have changed for me since November 8th. My whole paradigm, my whole life, for many of us, for millions of us, it's been a very different country to live in right now. But when you talk about to the both of you as hardcore scientists, because that's what you are, you study evidence, you do research, and you come up with conclusions. How do you know, like, what's a fact? What is evidence? How do you know that what you're reading or seeing? Does that question make sense? Like, you need to know that what you're reporting is facts also. So it's, how do you know what you know? How's that for a good question?
And actually, Kathy and I both present on this. We've been thinking about that question a lot. And I think that it should be first recognized that people, we're all different. And what we know, or how we know what we know, is different. Some people, quote unquote, know something because they heard it from their favorite radio show.
Hopefully it's a lot of really good stuff.
I'm talking AM. They heard it from a trusted source, or maybe their mother told them that. Scientists are wired to know things because they experiment. So our approach to knowing is we establish a hypothesis, a set of questions, a research design to collect the data that then either proves or disproves our hypothesis. And then if we don't know that enough, then we repeat it. Or we read the publications that a colleague, and a scientific colleague, has done the research in. So if we don't know something, we have to get more data, more understanding, more papers until we feel, okay, now we know that. That's not how everyone knows.
Right.
And I guess to follow up on that, if you look across the United States and the sources of information that people have, many of them we know are getting it from Fox News, or they're getting it from their local priest or minister, or they're getting it from some club that they belong to that they trust. And so everyone has a different set of trusted sources. If you're a scientist, you don't necessarily trust the source. You're actually looking for the underlying evidence. And I think that is a fundamentally different way of knowing.
Huge.
Than when you are essentially told what to believe and you swallow it whole. And that's what we're seeing, is that people are being told things they want to hear that are consistent with their worldview. And rather than thinking about it and really testing whether or not it's likely to be true, they're just accepting it. And this is a serious problem with our education system, because we haven't taught these people to question what they're hearing.
No, they're just supposed to memorize. That's all. That's what our education system has become. So words like salience, credibility, legitimacy, do they matter anymore? Are they just some like joke that's gone by the way? Because those terms used to matter, especially when it comes to science, scientific research, data, numbers that people spent years or weeks or months researching, that come out with conclusions based on that evidence. Do they seem relevant? Probably a two-part question. In your world, probably yes, but in the world out there, outside of academia?
I won't go into defining the terms. I would say salience, yes. Even in fact, it's especially important that whatever the information is, salient. And I think they're taking advantage of this sort of instant information out there and claim for expertise. Legitimacy, in the internet world, you don't have to be legitimate as a source of information. You can just say it.
You could be an expert, a self-proclaimed expert.
In an instant. And you could even, in your anonymity, you could actually claim any kind of voice or expertise. Credibility, I think, goes along with that. You can make it look like it is, that the information should be credible, even if, of course, it's not. So I would say legitimacy and credibility in the non-scientific world is probably dead.
Great.
I have to believe that this is a pendulum and that there will have to be some coming back. I don't know that it's over entirely. It's possible that there are still going to be a resurgence of people caring about facts and legitimate sources of information.
So for me, as someone that is obsessed lately about my age, not that I'm getting older, but that I am 66, and as I say, the third of my life, that gives me hope, Kath. And then I think, will I be alive to see it? Is the pendulum going to start swinging so I can do the happy dance before I, you know, cross over? And that remains to be seen. But I think sometimes the more severe things get, the better it is for that pendulum to start swinging. So that's what I hope.
I'm usually the more optimistic amongst the three of us.
But it's pretty hard these days.
I don't know. I think that the sort of wireless internet social media world has changed what this world likes permanently.
Yeah. Well, I think there'll be some things that we're just going to be sad about forever. And I want to die happy. Kathy, you had a huge role when you worked at the White House as the Assistant Director, Office of Science and Technology Policy. I wonder if they still even have one. Executive Office of the President from 2010 to 13. And your role was the director of the National Climate Assessment. You led a team of 300 authors and more than 1,000 contributors to the third National Climate Assessment report. And you were the lead advisor on water science and policy and climate adaptation within the OSTP. So when it comes to communication and public policy, this is a big question, but we have time. What's at risk? How can this sad diversion and separation from the importance of science and facts actually put us all at risk? That's how I feel. We're at risk because of what we are living in, our current reality.
Well, that's a giant question.
It is a giant question, but I had to ask you. It's like,
sure.
It matters. Look at the job you had in the White House. And now, is anybody doing this job even? I think there's like 3 people, you told me, from 300.
Yeah, there are very few people working in the Office of Science and Technology Policy now. And the few that are there are generally not qualified to actually be there.
Shocking.
And that being said, there is a National Climate Assessment proceeding, but it isn't actually being run out of the White House per se. It's being overseen, but at arm's length. So it hasn't been stopped. It is going. But your question about risk is absolutely critical. The whole point of understanding what the climate is doing and what the impacts are is to be prepared. And the pulling back that we're seeing from the basic investments in science are really going to affect people's livelihoods, the economy, their health, their welfare. We've just seen a series of extreme events. How do people think that they found out that they were going to be hit by a hurricane 6 to 8 days before it even happened? It was because of science and observations and monitoring. And one of the places that I'm most concerned about is not actually the assessment of knowledge itself. It's the fundamental underpinnings are being taken apart. The monitoring systems, the data systems, the investments in analysis, these are the things that have pushed us to where we are today. We understand a lot of the forces in the climate system, and we understand how they're connected to human risk. If we want to limit risk, we need more knowledge. We don't need to actually stop investing in these systems.
You know, when I went to the climate reality training, which is my big exposure to being the amateur scientist that I sometimes legend in my own mind think about, I learned a lot, like a lot. And those scientists, including Al Gore, in his presentations, they predicted these severe weather storms. They explained the science of why, what happens to CO2 emissions, where it gets stored in the atmosphere, how it contributes to severe weather. They had some examples, but they didn't even have in their scope what happened with the latest round of storms. When we have Puerto Rico, we don't even know what's going on there. Who would have thunk, right, that you could have that island? I have one of my friends, her family lives there. She has no idea if her family is alive, dead, probably alive, but are they trapped? Do they have food? Do they have water? And on. So they were predictable.
Let's jump into that.
Because yes, yes, yes.
And to add to what Kathy was just saying, the people who will say, okay, yep, science was good. We got some good information. The reason we were able to evacuate is because we had 4 or 5 days notice, and that's all good, and we believe that science. Those are the same scientists who are telling us that the climate is changing, humans are causing it, and that we should expect more severe weather. Why is it that people choose to believe the science that is coming from those scientists that is proven, and yet choose to believe at the same time that, when they talk to me about climate change, I'm not going to believe that. So credibility, it makes me think of Al Gore's inconvenient truth. It's an inconvenient truth because it's inconvenient to one's own, perhaps, belief set, or it doesn't fit into one's own politics. So we choose, let's believe these people on the one hand, but when they talk about something else, we won't believe it. And yet they're as expert.
You know, puzzling. And I wanted to say you have also vast experience working with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which I don't think they were able to even report on this as much because they've been decimated. Your presence on national boards and committees. What is at risk in these challenging times when many people in Washington don't seem to let facts get in the way, even in the wake of these dramatic storms? I feel like my life is at risk. So is that being a drama queen? I mean, I'm a drama queen. Anyway, I like that, but...
No, not at all. I think it not only should we be fearful of the future, we should be extremely fearful of the future and then act, not just
and
be
then
fearful.
Act, right, not be paralyzed by the fear.
That's
great,
right.
Message.
And if you were, if what you're talking about is in Washington, inside the Beltway, actually up on Capitol Hill or on Pennsylvania Avenue, part of Washington, I believe that those folks have never been motivated by truth. They've always been motivated by being reelected, by being advancing a particular agenda. Particularly the agenda that pays for their re-elections. And so you have to think about what kind of money, how much money is going to go in from special interests into what side of the argument. So, yes, very much at risk. I should tell you this very quickly, little story. When I first moved to Arizona back in 2003, I was stuck in a line at the airport. In front of me, so was stuck our Senator John McCain. And so, hey, I had him for 20 minutes before he got up to the front of the line. And I let him know that I had just moved here, where I was working, and asked him, because at that point the bill was out for debate. Interesting that bills be out for debate. And then vote. And his bill, the McCain-Lieberman bill on climate, was being considered. I asked him, what do you think is going to happen to your bill? And he said, oh, it won't pass very quickly. And I said, well, why would you say that? And he said, because there are way too many special interests in Washington. I said, well, then what are we going to do? And again, very quickly said, eventually we will have a bill because Mother Nature will force us. So he too was very much admitting that it isn't about truth informing policy, it's about special interest determining policy.
And boy, are we going to pay. Seriously. So I'm going to do my famous thing about asking a question. We're close to a break, but some of the research that you sent me in preparing for this show, there was a great article that I think was in June in the New York Times, and it was about how did the majority of GOP leaders come to view climate change as fake science? When and why did that happen? And I never put our guests on the spot, but can we start to answer that? When did it happen? Like, you're talking about 2003. I remember a time when you look at the Venn diagram, a big part of it was Republicans and Democrats working together because they knew, and I believe they still know, how much of a risk climate change is. And if they didn't know, they're getting knocked on the head because of what's happening to our country. It's coming to our country, our shores. You know, Miami's underwater on a regular basis. You see octopus floating down the street. That's the new normal. So when, from your perspectives of being researchers and committed to this for your entire careers, when did that start happening?
Boy, I wish I could point to a particular moment. And here I'm being optimistic again. I believe that it isn't an inherently Republican-Democratic thing. Truth is truth, and I believe that that the Republicans now in Congress have been so overwhelmed by needing to have a political win that even in the face of knowing that it's incorrect, they will move in that direction. And so
there it goes. So hold that thought. We'll be right back, and let's pick up on it when we come back. It's a really important question. Everybody stay here with me. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And hopefully by this point, your head's spinning with a lot of good thoughts. Thanks for listening. This hour, we're talking about navigating science to action in a post-fact world. Joining me for this hour are two people who are not only internationally recognized experts in their fields, but who care deeply and passionately about our planet, about the challenges we face as climate change continues to impact all of our lives, and who are doing something about it every day through their important work. So please join me once again in welcoming Jim Beiser, Deputy Director for Climate Adaptation and International Development, Institute of the Environment, Professor of Climate Adaptation, School of Natural Resources and the Environment. And Jim, I just want to know, do you put all that on your card? That's a lot.
Probably not. The font would have to be too small.
But people care. And Kathy Jacobs, Director, Center for Climate Adaptation, Science and Solutions Professor, both at the University of Arizona. Thanks so much for being here. And Jim, we had a kind of rush to the break there, but can you go back to answering that question about when and why did it happen with GOP leaders who have, you know, taken the lead now in just being climate deniers and putting us all at risk? So what's your finish the thought?
Well, over the break, Kathy reminded me, and this, she's exactly right, that the original law establishing the interagency U.S. Global Change Research Program, that is the federal government responsibility to come together and study climate change, was signed in 1990. That's a law of 1990. You remember it was a Republican administration there. So the original, so what is now a denial and comes out as a denial, it wasn't there in the Republican Party even as recently as the 1990s. And I think that, again, to go back to that, I think that, that it's just too imperative on the part of the political party that's opposing this to oppose it for political reasons. It isn't about we don't believe the facts. It's about it's an inconvenient truth.
I love it. Kath, you want to add to that?
Well, I would say that, unfortunately, Al Gore's presidential campaign really turned this into a political problem. I think prior to that, it wasn't really associated with Democrats or Republicans. And I think if he had been much more focused on solutions and building the economy rather than focusing almost exclusively on the risks associated with climate change, it might have been a theme that played better. But instead, what it did was sort of really force people into camps. And, you know, then it's from there really been used by political strategists. I mean, we certainly can't pin it all on Al Gore, who was simply trying to bring this issue to light so people understood it.
And now has dedicated his life to doing just that. And I'm telling you, you know, I wear my little green button around and people laugh at me. It's like laugh all day long. I'm so proud that I went to the Climate Reality Leadership Training and things that I think we're going to do to bring a lot of that information to Tucson and the general public. Another question for both of you. You work in academia. And Jim, I remember us going to lunch when a lot of the you know, the borders were being closed. So you have international students, you have people who have family here and they travel back to their countries, and God forbid they should be people of color. And I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. The profiling is, there's facts on that. In terms of these conversations, what kind of impact does this have on your students and the faculty members? The fact that you're in an environment where outside in the mass media, people are questioning it and denying it or saying it's a normal cycle. What's the impact on not just the morale, which matters, but the scientific process of really doing the research? How is it impacting your world with real people?
Well, I think there's a whole range of answers to that question. First of all, academia is sort of an island in a sea of other stuff.
Right.
And so some things that happen in academia are a little insulated from some of
this. Okay, so they're kind of impervious to the
at one level.
Okay.
That being said, we've seen students who are petrified that they're about leaving their families here because their skin's the wrong color. You know, we've seen people really concerned about whether they'll be able to get jobs when they get out of the university. We've seen changes in the funding stream. And most specifically, I think, within the federal agencies, it isn't even the directives, the really obvious changes that are happening because of legislation or even executive orders. It's this chilling effect on engagement with this topic. So if you're a federal agency that gives money to universities, you, first of all, have been told not to give money if it has the double C word in it,
right?
Climate
God
change.
God forbid we should say that.
So that's explicit. So they've sort of told people, let's stop talking about that. But honestly, in Arizona, that's been an issue anyway, because politics in Arizona has been like that for a while. So I've personally been affected by the fact that climate change is not considered a scientific issue by the politicians in Arizona.
And I think Kathy's exactly right, and I can give you a very specific example of sort of how it's affected students in the science. But I think your question is twofold, and the one gets a little bit away from the climate question, and that is, what is it like to be a non-white person in this country since November 8th? My spouse and mother of my children is Asian. We have a mixed family. It's not out of the question that they need to wonder if they're going to be treated differently if they get pulled over. And so it is much broader than that. Very specifically to the science, I have one of my graduate students is from Bangladesh. 2 days ago, he left for Bangladesh for 4 months of collecting data there. To Kathy's point, he left his wife and two little daughters here. He has no idea if he'll be able to be allowed to return to this country. It's a very real concern. We have had a lot of conversations about that. I tried to assure him making sure that his wife had my cell phone number, that if anything happened that she needed me, I was there. But that's more other than that, it's very difficult to reassure. He doesn't know whether Bangladesh shows up on someone's list coming out of Washington, D.C. It says, because that's a predominantly Muslim nation, we will not let people come from that country. You don't think that that will affect the science, his way of thinking, his ability? It does. And so my work, my science, is being directly affected by people who are now, since November 8th, having to worry about other things other than what the research that they're doing.
Right. And running a climate adaptation center, I mean, clearly we have that word right in the front end of what I do. And so funding for the actual work we do is definitely shrinking.
And I always wonder, I mean, there are really, really great foundations and institutions, and people say it's going to, you know, go to the private sector. And I've been on the side of that, and it's not going to make up for the government support, which is for all of its citizens. I just want to go back to something to kind of clear it up a little bit, because I think I really want We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to be very real in these conversations. And when I've done research, you're right. There are some presidents like Clinton who did some really horrible things under his administration, especially in the social justice arena, when it came to the Farm Bill, when it came to Monsanto and GMOs. There's not any lily white, so to speak, as a color, not of people, that are going to say they're clear. I mean, there has been some really compromises in both political parties and real heroes. So it isn't, let's not make that divide worse. And let's try and create an environment where those Republicans who know the truth and want to speak it and are afraid to not be reelected, that they come out and realize there are people like me that will be listening for their voice and listening in ways that I can support them so that we have a two-party system. So that was my comment. Okay, let's talk about, we have to talk about this, climate change, the big, you know, pie in the sky. What is that? I call it a faceless villain frequently. But there are clear and present dangers. They should make a movie out of that. When it comes to climate change, and I'd like very much to hear from both of you, what do you think some are the biggest threats to us as citizens of the planet or challenges that we're facing? Is it water? Is it dirty air? Is it the, you know, the devastation of national parks? In your field of work, Kath, let's start with you. What do you think we should be worried about the most? Because I don't want to have a Flint, Michigan in my city. You know what I mean? Thank God we have the city water department that we do. But what do you think, what should people listening to this show, men and women on the street, be concerned about?
Well, I think the most important message actually coming out of the third National Climate Assessment is that the way we experience climate change is different in every region and every sector of the country. And so those who live on the coast, sea level rise is a critical issue. And of course, if you live in low-lying areas anywhere, including near rivers, the fact that more intense precipitation is happening is a big deal. That's not the biggest threat in Arizona. The biggest threats in Arizona have to do with heat and large-scale fires, air quality issues, and health-related problems. Drought is ubiquitous as a sort of major thing to be concerned about. Of course, all of these things are very closely related, but it is really important to understand that if you live and work in Alaska and you're a Native American whose livelihood is dependent on harvesting particular kinds of plants or animals, you are affected so differently than someone who lives in a city. And the big issue there is whether the infrastructure is going to survive the next extreme event. So that's a really important thing. It's not one thing that any of us should be listening
right,
and worried about.
Right, and it depends a lot on where you are. Mm-hmm. And when you see somebody saying, oh yeah, global warming, look at this snowball, it's like it's really climate change. Thank you so much for clarifying that. Jim, do you want to add to that?
Well, just we could have a whole show on the clear and present dangers and outline them very, very specifically, from extreme weather events like what we've just seen and how climate change has actually made them more severe and will make them more frequent, to long-term drought, to health issues. We'll be getting diseases that they've been gone from this country. But let's maybe, if you let me, I'd like to point to one and then point to a solution, and a very sort of low-hanging fruit kind of solution. National security. When you have people around the world that are going to be displaced, whether it's 30 million Bangladeshis that have to find a home because their country's been flooded, or droughts that are causing unrest, that then you add sort of political things on top of it, then you have refugees. That's an instability within the international system. And the Department of Defense came out with a report that said that is a very serious thing.
Homeland security. It's one of their top priorities. Climate change.
This year, the president's budget has close to $700 billion for the first time, $700 billion with a B. That's almost three-quarters of $1 trillion in defense for 1 year. And a very large fraction of that is to protect our interests abroad. Very little of it, no matter what you hear, very little of that is really about keeping terrorists from attacking us. our interests abroad have a lot to do with access to oil, and that's the reason why we're spending so much. What if, here's a solution side, what if we produced all of our energy here? In fact,
which we could very quickly.
Very quickly. So what if we were to shortcut the process of solar, the energy coming in from the sun over hundreds of millions of years, turning it into the black stuff that we pull out of the earth, and just say, let's just shortcut that period and have the energy coming in from the sun, which sometimes turns into wind and geothermal ultimately. So we have access to it. All of the jobs would be here at home. We would be energy independent, so we wouldn't have to be spending that kind of money overseas to protect our access to oil. That's a solution, a very doable. And the last thing I'll say on that is yes, we have technological challenges, but we can solve them because they're technological challenges. They're not behavioral challenges. Those I don't know if we can change. But the technological ones, sure we can. We did when I was at Arizona State University, we did a study on how much solar would it take to power America. Well, guess what? It's 100 kilometers by 100 kilometer grid with existing technology 10 years ago would power America. Okay, we have a question about intermittency. It's not sunny all the time. And what do we do when it isn't? We have questions about transmission and power lines and all of that. But that's a technological issue.
That's being so studied, and we're making such advances. Mm-hmm. Just in the 10 years that I've been doing this, the advances in solar are astounding. Yeah. The cost, all of the new discoveries, I mean, it's there. The solution
is there. I just signed a contract
there.
to put solar on my rooftop yesterday.
Proud of you. Who did you use? Technicians
for sustainability.
One of the best.
Yeah, they were awesome.
Owned.
So yeah, anyway.
They are. No, but that's really good to know. That's an action people can take that are listening to the show if it's an affordable choice for them. So
clear and present danger, national security, and a solution.
National security, and people don't think of that. They don't connect those dots. And to think about that number of $7 billion and what we could do with that. And
$700 billion.
And then to impact real jobs. I mean, that has a ripple effect on the economy and unemployment and training people who are being displaced at a rapid rate by robots. You cannot have a robot install solar on your roof, at least not at this point, and hopefully not in my lifetime. But I mean, that's a real issue we're facing as a country, all of the people being displaced, you know, hundreds of thousands of them, even in fast food restaurants. That's a whole nother trajectory, but they're having robots make French fries. You know, somebody told me the other day that owns 5 restaurants, it's $10,000 for a robot to cook your fries, and the ROI is 6 months. So what are the choices when you're operating on a small margin? Okay, Kath, do you want to add anything to that? I mean, there are so many clear and present dangers, and I loved your answer. It's not just one thing that we have to be worried about our water. We have to worry about our lives in a really big picture.
Yeah, I guess the one thing I would say is people tend to focus on a single threat. They look at sea level rise, or they look at extreme precipitation, or they look at heat. What they don't think about is the connections between all of these things. So, for example, if it gets a lot hotter, then there's a lot more stress on the electrical grid, and you might have much larger wildfires. We're seeing that can actually take out the electrical grid, and then that takes out the communication system, the health system, the transportation system, or at least affects it. And so then you have a set of cascading effects. People really have a hard time even studying or understanding those, because it's about the connections between systems. And the way we always think is within systems. So that risk is really underestimated and needs a lot more work. That being said, once you know that, it's pretty easy to look for where those connections between the systems are and make them more robust. And that's what a lot of hazard mitigation managers, emergency managers do, is they do role-playing in scenarios of the future, trying to think about how these things cascade through time. This has a precedent in the military as well. They've always done scenario planning to prepare for future events that haven't occurred yet.
And, you know, I interviewed this guy, Grant Irvin, the show hasn't aired yet, from the city of Pittsburgh, and they're one of the 100 resilient cities that was designated by the Rockefeller Foundation. And talk about hope. They're planning to help their cities be resilient. And one of the things I love, and I'd like to talk about this a little bit after the next break, is they're the cross-pollination of information and research and ideas. So they get together and someone will say, well, we're going to try this in Berkeley. And Pittsburgh says, no, we tried that. And here's the downside to that. So there's really an information exchange of very important research and things that have been tried. So it's what you're talking about is it's integration of thought. It's not just one thing so that there's one simple solution. So everybody stay here with us. When we get back, I want to talk a little bit about the EPA and what the decimation of that means and some bring in a little bit of the social justice conversation. So everybody stay here with me. We've got a lot more good things to cover. 30 seconds, we'll be back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World, and I thank you so much for being a part of it. So how do we navigate science to action in a post-fact world? Joining us to help figure out some of those answers to those very big questions are James Beiser, Deputy Director for Climate Adaptation and International Development Institute of the Environment, Professor of Climate Adaptation School of Natural Resources and the Environment, and Kathy Jacobs, Director, Center for Climate Adaptation Science and Solutions, both professors at the University of Arizona. And again, it's truly wonderful to have you here and hear about the important work you have and just tapping into your knowledge and experience. It gives me hope. And some days I just want to pull the covers up over my head, but I don't. I want to bring up a little bit about the EPA and then talk about your role, Kathy, in gathering the troops, what's happening inside the very, you know, huge scientific community. But I have some friends at the EPA, and from where I sit, it's being decimated. So I'd like to have some response from both of you, if that's your read on it. I get bulletins every day about what's being eliminated. And how important is that agency for us as citizens of the United States? Should we be really concerned about all the things that are being dismantled or being talked about being dismantled? Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
You know, I like that name.
Right. I mean, I can't even imagine why citizens are not rising up more than they already
Me
are.
Me either.
Because people want clean air. They want clean water. They actually like biodiversity. They care about quality of the environment. It has everything to do with recreation and value.
Fishing, swimming.
Value of their
breathing.
Property. You know, the economy fundamentally is affected by what it is that EPA does. And so I think somehow it's been crafted as the EPA is anti-business and anti-economy and anti-jobs. And there's so much evidence that that's not true that it's just astonishing to me that there hasn't been a more effective pushback on that.
Post-fact world. Jim Beiser?
It's okay
if we get you started. It's okay. Get started.
What is happening to the EPA is I think, well, it is believable because we should start believing that, in fact, candidate, Donald Trump, is who we saw. So when someone shows you who they are, believe them. And we shouldn't be surprised that what he's doing with the EPA right now. Kathy's right. It needs to be there. The EPA absolutely must be there. I had the interesting and good fortune to, when I first got to Arizona, to be on a board with Barry Goldwater Jr., the son of our senator. And everyone should know Barry Goldwater's politics are quite libertarian. And so a lot of the conversation was that when we were driving to from Phoenix to Payson once a month, was what is the role of government? And at one point I asked him, what would your father say that to the question, should government be involved in protecting the environment? And in his very deep voice, he said, Beiser, I'll get back to you on that. The next day he called me and he said, I thought about it. And the government should absolutely play a role in protecting the environment because we as humans won't.
Don't I have a right to breathe clean air as a citizen of the United States? That's I feel like my rights as a citizen are being stomped on. And you know, this next question is it's not political. I want to stay away from that. It's just seem to be a preponderance of people in one political party. But I wrote in my newsletter last week, do people really think that the dirty air, the rivers and oceans, the pollution that will occur, the devastation of wildlife habitat, do they think that's only going to impact people in one party, or do they think the air they breathe, do you think they're going to be immune to it? Like, what are they not thinking about that my thoughts about this have nothing to do with how I vote? And that's the truth. I care. I want to breathe clean air. I thought most consciously living people did. I don't want sludge in our waterways. I love nature. So where's that thinking? Why aren't they connecting the dots that this is our air and our waterways and our rivers? Does that make sense? A little bit of my political rant.
Well, I think the part that astonishes me even more is it isn't us of this generation who are really going to bear the brunt of this.
I know,
it's our
Kev.
Children and grandchildren. Oh. And all of these people have children and grandchildren. So I can understand the sort of intent to maximize or optimize profit in the short term. In the context of a business, I get that, although it would make more sense to me to have a sustainable business practice, but that's just my perspective. But I cannot understand these people all have children and grandchildren. How can that not matter? And what is the disconnect that's required? I mean, they must be forcibly pushing their synapses apart. I cannot understand how they can live in this dichotomous world.
I can't either.
And if exactly, but if we would if someone wants to know what it looks like to have a decimated or no EPA at all, they ought to join me in some of my trips to the developing world. Because and just wade through the garbage in the streets, look at the streams. That's what it looks like when you don't have an EPA or you have an agency that doesn't have teeth to it. So just, you know, join me, and you'd be able to see that. That's why sometimes I refer to the U.S. as the largest undeveloping country in the world, because that's where we're headed. And this is evidence.
And we're heading straight backwards. Let's talk a little bit about social justice, because it is such a component of this. So from your perspective, from your research, are marginalized poorer communities more at risk for the impact of climate change? And if so, how so? And then the two parts to that is, you know, I know what I hope your answers are, but feel free. That has an impact on all of us as well. We don't think so, because people might say, you know, that's the poor neighborhood. That's the other side of the tracks. That's this, that's that. Not realizing the contribution those people make to us. So what about the social justice issue? Should we care? And how do we help mitigate it?
Well, that is a really big question.
No, I'm asking those. It's like we need 2 hours.
Yes.
But you have really big answers.
Yeah. Well, the answer is absolutely. Of course, we should care. But again, this sounds very sort of top down and preachy. How do you reach people who aren't in daily contact with people who are of color or who are elderly or who are for other reasons, health compromised? It's very easy in the United States to sort of draw your blinds and not even look across the street, let alone across town or across the country. And yet, what's happening globally is even more dramatic and shocking in terms of equity issues, the haves and the have-nots. And of course, what we really have done by generating a lot of carbon dioxide in the developed countries is force the impacts onto a whole set of people who had nothing to do with the benefits of using fossil fuel. And of course, that's just a huge issue. Those people are now developing and they want to have our standard of living. And that's a major problem unless technology can leapfrog, which we know it can with the right kind of economic and political support.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because when I saw Inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power, the guy from India that made the point, oh yeah, great, United States, you use fossil fuel to get where you are, and you're an industrialized nation, but you want me to sign this protocol saying I will drastically reduce it. We're not an industrialized nation, and it's cheap, and it's available, and that's what we're going to use. So that's your point. We used it. Now, the case could have been made that we're, you know, trying to control the use of fossil fuel, but it was what got us where we are.
Right. And India, by the way, as you know, did sign the Paris Agreement.
Yes.
And the U.S. now, only U.S. and Syria are the only two countries in the world that are not, or at least this president is trying to withdraw us. I think that Kathy's right. I work in the developing world, so I can see it in spades all the time, the social injustice. A couple of things. One is you don't have to go to those countries to see it. All you have to do is look at the aftermath of Harvey. Well, and let's just study that. Should we study, and you will see that, A, if you didn't have the money to jump in a car, because maybe you didn't have a car, you didn't have the wherewithal to leave, and so therefore you had to weather through it. And B, your homes, because they aren't the kinds of homes that if you're wealthier, maybe you have two or three homes, one happens to be in Houston, those are also gone, so there you are. And how long will that take for them to recover? Should we care? It's hard for me to answer because I'm wired to care about what happens to my fellow men. I know that not everyone is, but they should. Even if, to Kathy's point, if it was just for own economic self-interest, they should. They're not thinking it through. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, because we are going to have to talk a little bit about solutions. And Kathy, what are you doing? You, Kathy Jacobs, because you had a very high-level position in the White House, a really important job. Is there hope? Are organizations and scientists and groups coming together to help be part of the change?
Well, yes.
Give me some hope here, Kath. Throw me a lifeline.
Yeah, there actually is an astonishing amount of activity. A lot of it is behind the scenes and not...
And not in the news?
Deliberately being
good.
Behind the scenes working on these issues. And one of the pieces of evidence, for example, is the response to the public, or the response of the public to the proposals regarding taking the national monument systems down. There were millions of comments. That didn't just happen. That was actually organized. And those are the kinds of things where really getting the democracy to work from the ground up is a fundamental piece of the solution of all of this. And we've seen that. We've seen people like myself. I'm much more politically active today than I was a year ago.
Me too, than I ever was in my life.
I'm actually not a political person, which probably sounds ridiculous when I worked in the White House, but I was absolutely there to get a job done and be completely focused on the outcome. It had nothing to do with my politics.
Please
or the politics.
Please bring that up. It is such a good point. It wasn't political at all. You happened to be in the White House with a Democratic president, but what you were studying, it crosses all political.
Absolutely.
They don't even enter into the conversation.
Right. But one of the things we did do in the National Climate Assessment was build something called the NCA Network, which now has 180 organizations as part of it. And granted, what's going on with the National Climate Assessment now is nothing like what was happening when we were in our full rollout strategy from the last one. But there is still an organization, a big network there. And those the organizations have hundreds of thousands of members collectively. That's incredibly powerful. And so one of the things I've been doing recently is working with many of those professional societies and states and mayors, Democrat and Republican, trying to build something called the Science to Action Community. And the whole focus of that is to sort of bring back facts, support the people who are actually protecting the environment, support the government and its regulations and priorities, because we really do need these the benefits of all of this to be better articulated. And when you have relatively powerful organizations, some of these have 500,000 members, and you band those together and you have a common goal, which is sharing information, sharing strategies, there's a lot that can be accomplished. And so I do think there's a lot of hope. That being said, there's a lot more hope if facts matter than if facts don't matter. That's our challenge still.
And having shows like this, which I hope will be heard by thousands of people, and my shows are, it's, to me, it's, you got to the quintessence of what we have to do. And we can't be asleep, and we can't be complacent, and it's not business as usual. I mean, I have marched in 3 marches in 2017, which is the total of marches I have marched in. You know what I mean? And there'll be more, and I'm ready, and I want to march. And my husband came, and he said, I'm not going to chant, and I'm not going to hold a sign, but I'm going to be a presence for the right thing. So I think that if there is an upside, that is it. So let me ask you this. I had a woman on the show that said, conscious consumerism, the big lie, that, you know, you can save all the plastic bottles you want, all the straws you want, all of the, you know, get on the bus, don't drive your car. But that's really not enough, that we have to get involved in policy changes at the local, state, regional, national level. Response?
I absolutely agree. And what we also see is there are some incredible heroes. I can't even imagine what kind of pressure Susan Collins and John McCain have been facing,
but health, yes.
To have people like that to look to, who are not Democrats, who are really being personally brave, I want every one of our elected officials to behave the way they do and actually take into account what it is that they stand for, which is presumably the citizens of the United States. And it's really unclear to me who the rest of these people are working for.
Agreed.
We absolutely, we all do and should do what we need to as individuals to play our part in the solution side of things. But I absolutely agree that to have a real impact, maybe what you do is contribute your time and money into helping support people who could put themselves into policy roles. Yesterday, I had the good fortune of being at our mayor's house, Mayor Rothschild, and for a fundraiser for a U of A faculty, Kirsten Engel, who's a state representative, District 10, and it was a fundraiser for her. She went into this, and when I asked her, why did you do this? She went into this precisely because of the things that we've just been talking about. She is worried. She's concerned. She has a child. She wants to do good, and she believed that the platform needed to be a higher platform in order to do that. So I think you're exactly right.
It's shocking to me. I had lunch last week with a friend that I met at the Climate Reality Training in Denver, and she's doing exactly that. She's up in the pine, strawberry, you know, the upper part of the state, and she is a pistol, and she said, I just decided I had to run for office. And it's a very Republican area. It's a red area. She's a veteran, and it's helping her, and they're listening. And she's not leading with climate change. So everybody, time flies when you're learning, having fun, and getting challenged. And this was amazing to me. I really couldn't wait for this show. And I appreciate not just your being on the show, but what you're doing to make a difference and inspiring me and being a source that I can turn to, that I trust for the real facts. I'm not a big alt fact person. So October 12th, Amy Fregnosi and Jordan Richardson from Child Life Specialists at TMC, doing amazing work with our children and our future. TMC really cares. And October 17th, Grant Irvin, Building a Resilient City, Pittsburgh Style. Thank you, everybody. Make it a great green week and get involved.
Thank you, Gina.
Thanks. That was great.